Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today is United Nations Day. With the recent Trump administration decision to withdraw from UNESCO, the UN's International Scientific and Cultural Heritage Organization, today we meet an Oklahoma-born historian and anthropologist responsible for recognizing one of UNESCO's most recent tentative World Heritage Sites. Joseph Opala is a noted historian for establishing the Gullah connection between the indigenous people of Sierra Leone in West Africa and the Gullah culture in the coastal Carolinas and Georgia, and how those people spread across the country, even into central Oklahoma, with the Seminole Nation during Indian removal. From Bunce Island, a British slave fort that Opala rediscovered while a Peace Corps volunteer in the 1970s, his research has determined that most of the African slaves that came directly to the United States came from that location, and says it's the most important historic site in Africa for the United States. Opala, who's the son of the late longtime Oklahoma Supreme Court Justice Marion Opala, is the guest for tonight's United Nations dinner event for the UN Association of Eastern Oklahoma. He'll be speaking about the African Oklahoma Gullah connection, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Joseph Opala, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
You're going to be speaking for United Nations Day for the United Nations Association on the Gullah connection, which most people say that you're the person that really came up with this Gullah connection. What is the Gullah connection?
Well, I'm not sure I came up with it. I sort of fell into it. I'm from Oklahoma. But after university, I went with the Peace Corps to a little country in West Africa called Sierra Leone. And I discovered when I was there that there was a unique connection between Sierra Leone and a Black American community known as Gullahs, who live in coastal South Carolina and Georgia. Many of the slaves who were taken from Sierra Leone wound up in coastal South Carolina and Georgia. And later in their history, some of those people escaped from slavery and migrated south into Florida, where they joined in various ways, collaborated in various ways with the Seminole Indians. And over a period of several decades in the early 1800s, the Gullahs, who now call themselves Estalusti, or Black people, and are known today as Black Seminoles, the Black Seminoles there in Florida, together with their Indian allies, fought off the U.S. military for several decades and ultimately migrated in a number of different directions. Some of them came west to what is now Oklahoma, and we find their descendants today in Seminole County, Oklahoma. Around 1850, though, some of the Black Seminoles migrated south across Texas to get back across an international border again, and they went into northern Mexico, where they were well-received by the Mexican government. The Mexicans simply said, you can have land, and we're happy that you're here, but we want you to help us fight off the Indians who are attacking us, same Indians who are attacking the other side of the border as well, the Comanches and Apaches. And they were so effective at that after the Civil War and after emancipation, the U.S. cavalry sent representatives across the border into Mexico and said, you're welcome to come back into the United States if you're willing to serve in the Army. And the cavalry formed a special unit called the Seminole Negro Indian Scouts. They weren't buffalo soldiers because they had the same skills that Indians had at tracking and interpreting what the enemy was doing by looking at the trails that they had left behind. And these were an amazing group of people because they had spent decades fighting the U.S. Army in Florida. They had spent more decades fighting Indians in Mexico, and now that they're back in the United States, they were astonishing warriors. And in just a very few years after the Seminole Negro Indian Scouts was formed in 1870, four of them had won the Congressional Medal of Honor in various battles with the Comanches and Apaches. So I sort of stumbled on this historical saga that starts in West Africa, continues on to South Carolina and Georgia, then down into Florida, ultimately to my home state, to Oklahoma, and then down into Mexico and back into Texas after the Civil War. And there's some things that actually don't change along that very long saga. One thing is that people all along that historical progression were rice eaters. The reason that many people from Sierra Leone were taken into slavery in South Carolina and Georgia was because they were expert rice planters, and the economies of those colonies were based on rice agriculture. They were also able to use their rice growing skills effectively in Florida, in that tropical climate, and they grew rice effectively and even traded it with the Indians. They stopped growing rice, obviously, when they were taken west, though they did try to grow rice in Oklahoma.
Interesting.
But they always ate it, and they're still eating rice, and interestingly enough, even preparing it and cooking it as far south as Mexico, Texas, and Oklahoma. Cooking it very similarly to the way the Gullah people make it today in South Carolina and Georgia, and people in Sierra Leone. There's also a language in common all the way from West Africa into Mexico, including Oklahoma, a language that is very similar in all of those scattered locations. And when Gullahs or Black Seminoles and Sierra Leoneans hear each other speak, there's always astonishment. And a number of years ago, I was actually, with the help of the Sierra Leone government, I was able to bring a number of Black Seminoles and from Oklahoma and Gullahs from South Carolina and Georgia to Sierra Leone. They were received by the Sierra Leone government as a long-lost family returned, and there were a number of events along the way there. That was in 1989. There were a number of events in which they were able to observe each other's languages, and there was always just utter astonishment.
How similar are the languages in their purest forms from, say, West Africa to Seminole? Is it a matter of the slang terms from West Africa sort of going into the Seminole dialect, or are there similarities from the start?
Well, it's a little bit complicated. First of all, you know, Seminole, if you just say Seminole, that's the Indian language.
Right.
That the Seminole Indians speak. But although the Black Seminoles, many of them, it's recorded, did speak Seminole or Muscogee.
Uh-huh.
In the 19th century. In fact, some still speak the language today in Oklahoma. I'm talking about something different. In Sierra Leone, there's a language called Creole, which is a kind of a hybrid of English and African languages, and it goes back into the slave trade era. This a very similar language developed among the Gullah people in coastal South Carolina and Georgia, a language that they really have never liked to share with outsiders. But it has been studied aggressively since the 1940s, and it's very similar. It's a hybrid of the English and African languages. We know the Black Seminoles took it with them to Florida because you can find it today in Oklahoma and in Texas and in northern Mexico. I recently visited with some of the Black Seminoles in Texas, and I heard expressions that I knew from Sierra Leone. And there are words from African languages spoken in Sierra Leone, also loan words, that are found in both Gullah and the Black Seminole speech, all the way down to Mexico. So it's an astonishing continuity all along this this historical saga.
This is very surprising, because when I think of the Gullah society, I think of this as a very closed and isolated society. Were you surprised by the breadth of the diaspora from that community across the Western Hemisphere?
Well, it took some time, obviously, for me to understand how, you know, all of this had happened. But I'm not surprised in a way, because when you get to know Gullah folks, there's a tremendous determination that they have to remain, as you said, isolated, but also to remain self-sufficient. And you can see that all the way through. They're a very, very similar attitude. I mean, those folks who escaped slavery and went down to Florida showed a level of determination to maintain their own economy there and survive there in that wilderness, and then, if necessary, to, you know, fight to the death to maintain their freedom. Down in Florida, there were several generations of these Black Seminoles who were born in freedom. And in the end, what happened in the Seminole Wars, the Second Seminole War in particular, is the army literally was fought to a standstill in a six-year war in the 1830s. And the U.S. Army realized that they could not actually defeat the Black Seminoles. And they appealed to Congress for funds to take them to Africa. They didn't think that it was safe to leave them in the continental United States. And ultimately, the Army did what they felt they had to do, and without permission from the government. They made a deal with the Black Seminoles in Florida that they would take them west from Tampa up the Mississippi and then up the Arkansas River into Indian Territory, take them free. And with their weapons and with their families and with their possessions, they had to cut a deal like that because they really had no choice. They couldn't continue fighting them indefinitely in Florida. And the commanding general there in Florida actually sent a dispatch to Congress and said, "Gentlemen, be assured that this is a Negro and not an Indian war." And on another occasion, he said, we know as much of the interior of Florida as we do the interior of China." The Black Seminoles were using their knowledge of their territory there in Florida to run skirmishes and ambushes, and it was really just beyond the capacity of the U.S. Army to defeat them at that point. The Black Seminoles also had resistance that Africans from their area have against malaria and yellow fever, which had taken root in Florida and killed many of the native Indians that were there. And the American soldiers were very badly affected by malaria and yellow fever. A U.S. Army doctor whose job was to examine the Black Seminoles who had agreed to come west for resettlement wrote in his diary, "These are the finest looking people I have ever seen." He was stunned because he had spent long months treating American troops with tropical fevers. And these people were in very good physical condition in that same environment. So between the rice that they could grow in the tropics there and feed themselves and their Indian allies, and their physical ability to survive well in that disease environment, they were very tough customers and in the end really impossible to defeat.
Now, this all began for you when you were in the Peace Corps serving in Sierra Leone, and you ran across Bunce Island. And Bunce Island has become still is very important to you. You've been working on the restoration and stabilization of this particular island. This was it's a very sad place. It's where many Sierra Leoneans and tribal members from that area embarked, coming directly to America. And it's one of the few West African slave spots where the people enslaved actually came directly to America. Is this correct?
I would say directly to North America.
Yeah, North America.
That is correct. It surprises people when they learn, in terms of the Atlantic slave trade, that of the roughly 10 million people who were taken across the ocean and survived the passage, only about 4% of them came to what is now the United States. The vast, vast majority of them wound up in Caribbean islands and in Brazil and in other fully tropical areas in the Caribbean basin where sugar could be grown. The crops that were grown up here in North America, cotton, rice, tobacco, indigo, these were valuable, but nowhere near as valuable as sugar. Because slavery had such a huge impact on our development as a nation, and we tend to think that slavery must have been centered here, but it was not. It has certainly had a huge impact. But the vast majority of plantations and the vast majority of the money made from enslaving people on plantations is really farther south into fully tropical areas. The reason that Bunce Island is a British slave trading base in Sierra Leone, the reason that it had such a strong connection to North America really is rice. Rice planters in South Carolina and Georgia were actually willing to pay higher prices for Africans who came from rice-growing areas. With rice, you don't need labor, you need a technician. It's a very complicated crop to grow. And the Africans coming from Sierra Leone and the surrounding area were really experts at the cultivation of rice. And that's sort of the beginning of my journey of discovery. When I began research on Bunce Island, on the ruins of this British slave castle, I assumed that the vast majority of the African captives who were taken from there must have gone to the Caribbean, because only 4% in any event wound up in North America. But when I discovered that, in fact, a large percentage of the Africans taken from Sierra Leone and through Bunce Island wound up in South Carolina and Georgia, that really sparked my interest. So initially, I started looking at the connections there to South Carolina and Georgia, went to that area, did research in archives there, met with members of the Gullah community whose ancestors had grown rice. That got me very excited because it connected this place where Sierra Leone that I had really come to love with my own country. But then later, when I realized that many of the Gullah's ancestors actually managed to escape to Florida, fought these heroic struggles with their Indian allies against the U.S. military, and then, of all things, wound up, some of them, in Oklahoma. You can imagine my astonishment. I had gone far, far away when I joined the Peace Corps to Sierra Leone, and then wound up right back where I came from in Oklahoma. In fact, the first time I made or tried to make contact with the Seminole Freedmen, as they're called, or Black Seminoles mm-hmm. in Oklahoma, I just got a county map, and somebody in Wewoka, Oklahoma, showed me where in this rural area where I could meet with Seminole Freedmen. And I just drove out into that area, the kind of maze of dirt roads. And my plan, which is kind of crazy, was if I could speak to people, I thought I will speak to them in the language that I learned in Sierra Leone. I didn't yet have enough information on their language other than I knew it was very similar. And I did that. And I thought, well, if they look at me like I'm crazy, I'll know that they don't really speak this language anymore. But if they're just kind of avoiding me or suspicious of me, maybe there's something there. And I saw a group of teenagers on the side of the road, and I got out, and I actually greeted them in the language I had learned in the Peace Corps in Sierra Leone, asked them the question in that language, do you speak anything like this here in this area? And the teenagers didn't say a word, and I just stood there waiting for them to reply if they were going to, and finally one of them said, in English, well, I guess my grandpa talks a bit like that. And of course, you can imagine my feeling right there in Seminole County, having that kind of response. Later, I was welcomed into people's homes. I was fed rice dishes that were very similarly prepared to what I was accustomed to in West Africa. And people began to share the language with me. And I learned that just as it is in Sierra Leone, they identified themselves as rice eaters. People in Sierra Leone will tell you that right away. We're rice eaters. And these people did the same.
My guest today is Joseph Apala. He is the historian who has helped establish the Gullah Connection, and he'll be the speaker for United Nations Day, a celebration by the United Nations Association of Eastern Oklahoma taking place tonight. He'll be speaking as a part of the UN Day dinner, which raises funds for the UN Association here in the local area. And of course, his father was longtime Oklahoma Supreme Court Justice Marion Apala, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. That connection between actual Gullah communities and Sierra Leone is incredibly tight. You've done a number of Gullah reunions in which a lot of the cultural traditions, the foods, the language is incredibly similar to modern-day Sierra Leoneans and modern-day Gullahs along the coast.
And the Black Seminoles in Oklahoma and Texas. The first homecoming that I organized with the help of the Sierra Leone government and the United States Embassy in Sierra Leone included Gullah folks from South Carolina and Georgia and Seminole freedmen from Oklahoma. And part of the joy for me and the astonishment as well in traveling around Sierra Leone with these folks is that I saw the Gullahs and the Black Seminoles' amazement at all of the similarities in language and culture that they were seeing there in Africa. But then since I was with them, I also heard them discussing among themselves their similarities in culture and in language. And I was seeing astonishment in two different ways. Black Seminoles from Oklahoma and the Gullahs were rediscovering each other. I mean, their communities had no direct contact in 150 years. So that was quite exciting there as well.
And it also gives these families who, when they look at their heritage, there's this gigantic gap through slavery, and all of a sudden they reconnect with heritage that they probably thought was long lost, never to be discovered.
That's right. And Sierra Leoneans were excited because, I mean, their country's very small by African standards. It's about the same size as South Carolina, in fact. And it has never had a very large population. So when you look at where African captives were taken from in Africa, not that many were taken from Sierra Leone. I mean, other countries that are huge today, I mean, the area that's now Nigeria, for instance, many, many people were taken from there. So Sierra Leoneans thought, I thought rightly, that it would not be likely that there would be anywhere in the Americas among African descendants where their language and their culture and memories of their country would be retained. They would have just sort of blended in with much larger groups coming from elsewhere in Africa. But because of this rice connection, because there was one little spot in North America where the slave owners wanted Africans from their area for their rice growing skills, a lot of people from a little small part of West Africa got concentrated in a little small part of North America. So for Sierra Leoneans themselves, this was very exciting to find that they had relatives, family from their area that they could relate to in lots of different ways through their language and also through their rice eating and various other things.
I mentioned your father was Oklahoma Supreme Court Justice Marion Apollo, one of our finest jurists here in the state, who fought in the Polish underground in World War II. And with that war and the Cold War afterwards, I assume the Apollos lost contact with most of the rest of their family. How has your own family history affected this research on this diaspora of West Africans to first the Gullah area of the coastlands and the diaspora through Florida, Oklahoma, and the West? Has that had an impact on how you've viewed this research?
Yes, of course it did. I, unlike most people, I really had no family at all to speak of. From on my father's side, what family he had left in Poland, we could not contact, and they could not contact us during the Cold War period. Once the Iron Curtain came down, I only learned in later years that my father's sister tried to write him on one occasion, and she was arrested by the communist secret police in Poland and jailed. And she was released after a couple of weeks, but they told her that if she ever tried that again, that she would never emerge from prison. So there was no contact at all. And when my father learned that his mother was dying in the 1970s, he called the Polish embassy, still communist Poland then, and I was just happened to be in his office when he made the call, and it turned into a shouting match, because they told him that he was, because he had come to the West, he obviously was very anti-communist. They said, you are a traitor to your country, we don't owe you any favors. And I remember there was this very angry discussion in Polish, and then he just slammed the phone down. Well, I also didn't have any relatives, oddly enough, on my mother's side. Her parents had grown up in a very impoverished part of Tennessee and were the first people in their families, in both cases, to even get a high school education. And in the 1920s, my mother's parents became kind of poverty refugees, and they went north to try to get education. And my grandfather wound up getting a PhD in biology. And his first and only job was at Oklahoma Baptist University. So my mother didn't know anyone in her family beyond her parents, because they really broke off contact with family in Tennessee. It was the memories that they didn't, of poverty that they didn't want to keep fresh in their mind. So I really didn't grow up with family. Although, amazingly, after my parents had died, grandparents, obviously, the only blood relative I had in the world that I knew of was my half-brother, my mother's son by a later husband who lives in Oklahoma. And then 3 years after my father passed away, of all things, I got an email from his niece, his sister's daughter. And my dad had gone to Poland as soon as the wall came down, and he went there in 1990. And he went to his hometown, and he was told that his sister was dead, and so was his niece. And lo and behold, 3 years after he passed away, she contacted me. And since then, we've seen each other on three occasions. She's the one who told me about her mother attempting to write my dad and winding up in prison for that. And she sent me this trove of photographs. I'd never seen my grandmother's face. I'd never seen my grandfather's face. I'd never seen her mother's, my aunt's face. So that was pretty astonishing for me. So yes, in a sense, I've tried to help people on both sides of the Atlantic do what I yearn to do, which is to connect with lost family. And perhaps in some cosmic sense, my reward was that my cousin came out of the void and restored a lot of that lost family for me.
I know you've been working to make Sierra Leoneans aware of Bunce Island and its importance to their heritage as well as to African Americans. About this is perhaps the final stopping place before their families and their forebears came to America. And I have to ask you, as we approach this United Nations Day, the Trump administration decided to withdraw from UNESCO, the International Scientific and Cultural Heritage Organization, that might have a role in preserving someplace like Bunce Island or preserving cultural heritage across nations. I'm wondering what you're thinking about that decision.
Well, it's not the first time that that has happened. You know, UNESCO has been fraught for a long time with politics. And I remember at one point in the 1980s, they tried to create some sort of news bureau that was separate from that of the West and would reflect more the views of communist countries. So you can see there has been a lot of politicizing. And nonetheless, I mean, UNESCO, which is based in Paris, by the way, and is the cultural branch of the United Nations, I mean, whatever you say about the politics, it's also an extremely important institution. And the fact that it designates World Heritage Sites is very important. They don't have a lot of money, but the fact that they can point to a site and say it's a World Heritage Site, this is one of the most important historical sites in the world, and I have not seen that politicized to any great extent. The places they pick really are important. That's hugely valuable. And although you may not be able to get money through them, the fact that you have that designation allows you to raise awareness and raise funds from other sources. And I'm proud to say that due to some of the work that I was involved in, UNESCO has recognized Bunce Island now as a tentative World Heritage Site. That process of declaring something a World Heritage Site usually takes 10 years or more. So when they say something's tentative, they mean it's on the way. So that's hugely valuable. That means global recognition for an historic site.
Well, we wish you great success with your continuing work with this Gullah connection and your work at Bunce Island. Joseph Apollo, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
Historian Joseph Apollo speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll be talking about the Gullah connection tonight for the United Nations Day celebration by the United Nations Association of Eastern Oklahoma tonight at Gilchrist Museum. And there are still a few seats available for tonight's event. Visit unaeo.org and select United Nations Day for information. Proceeds from the event will support global education and model UN programming for high school and college students here in eastern Oklahoma. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.